Hey everyone, I'm Coach Al Lyman.
And I'm Dr. Kurt Strecker, and we are the experts behind Pursuit Athletic Performance, one of the nation's cutting-edge sports training companies with an outstanding reputation for getting athletes just like you stronger, more powerful, and faster, all while keeping you uninjured and in the game year after year.
Our weekly podcast will share honest, effective training tips and information, from the nuances of triathlon to the rigors of ultra running, as well as the latest in sports medicine and nutrition. Our goal is to explode the training myths and untruths marketed to athletes and to teach you how to truly unleash your ultimate potential. Be sure to subscribe for free updates of our proven strategies at pursuitathleticperformance.com.
Hey everybody, this is Coach Al Lyman. I'm your host for this new edition of the Pursuit Athletic Performance Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really, really excited because I've got a special guest. This particular individual has been around in the sport of triathlon for what seems like forever. He's really got a unique business model going on now with endurance sports travel. I want to welcome to our podcast none other than Ken Glaw. Ken, how are you doing today?
Very good. Thanks, Al.
Ken, so that our listeners have a sense of who you are and a little bit of your history. I know, as I mentioned in that little introduction, you've been a triathlete for a long time, been in the sport for a very, very long time. Give our listeners a little sense of who you are. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm pushing 50 right now. Been in the sport since 1982, so I only missed a few of the first years of the sport. And I'm just, a dedicated triathlete and just love training, love the sport, love most of the people in the sport, and came from a running background. And I guess the thing that really drew me to the sport was the fact that I love to train. And, as a runner, you could run 100, 120 miles a week or something, but you really couldn't do a whole lot more than that before, risking injury. So with triathlons, when I was in my heyday and before I started my business, I was training anywhere from 30 to 40 hours a week, and that's what I'd love to do. There's nothing better than being out there on the road or in the pool. So that's really what drove me to the sport and has kept me in it. Unfortunately, I don't get to train very consistently anymore, but I certainly enjoy every moment that I'm out there.
Right. That's awesome. I had this idea to bring you onto our podcast for a couple of reasons. First was, of course, to talk a little bit about your business, Endurance Sports Travel, which we'll do in a moment. When I was looking online for some videos around Kona this year back in October, I came upon an interview that you were doing. I believe it was Bob Babbitt and someone else, and you in that interview had an opportunity to discuss a little bit about your history with that amazing and very famous race, obviously, on the Big Island. And I think you've got a legacy there that's really remarkable. Tell our listeners a little bit about your history in Kona. How many years have you done Kona now?
This was my 30th finish in a row.
Wow, that's incredible.
1984 was my first race out there, and I've been there every year since.
That's a remarkable legacy, not only of your durability as an athlete, but obviously your ability to train consistently. And you spoke earlier about the fact that you love to train, and having that many hours in your body probably makes it easier to return year after year. What are some of the most memorable races that you've had there? I know you've finished in the top 10 a few times. Never won the race, right?
No, I think I have about 10 top 10 finishes, but the best placing I ever did was third, and a couple fourths, a couple fifths. my fastest time was from one of the years when I was fifth. But yeah, it's the first, the first year or two was definitely a learning experience, and then I was pretty consistent for about 15 years until I started the business, and then things started tailing off after that. But you're right, the muscle memory from the 15 or 20 years when I was putting in a lot of training, I still live off that a little bit. So I think that really shows how being consistent, and I do a lot of base work. And so, if I go out now and I train for 3 or 4 weeks, as long as things go well on race day, I can still go somewhere between 9:30 and 10 hours on just 3 or 4 weeks of training. But it's getting harder and harder because I'm now, I guess I'm 10 years away from when I did consistent training last, so.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. As I think about that, I know from a coaching perspective, it would make sense to me. And I also have a running background predominantly before I came into the sport, but it would make sense to me that running would be the thing that would be toughest to put together in a relatively short period of time. You know, relatively speaking, you've got the stroke technique and the swim volume in your body and certainly a really huge cycling base. You know, one of the things that really resonated with me when I listened to your interview, and I just laughed to myself, was because it's so predominant here in our lab, where we're doing predominantly movement and gait analysis and working with a lot of injured athletes trying to get back out there. You talked about how you're sitting more now than ever and how that's really impacted your ability to stay strong and balanced and keep your running together. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, how have things changed for you over the years? Certainly your business has got you traveling a lot more miles in an airline seat. But how do you feel those things have changed for you, and how has it impacted your training and your racing and even specifically your running?
Well, definitely sitting at a desk is, or sitting in an airline seat in a car, whatever. Sitting is not good for you. I never had any serious injuries that were training related. I mean, I had, bike accidents, things like that. But as far as overuse injuries, shin splints when I was a kid were really the only thing that I ever had that was a training-related issue until I started sitting at a desk. And then, everything started tightening up. Things didn't move as freely, and that's really when I started having issues. And I, for the most part, have avoided anything serious. But movement is definitely what my body's made for, and I think everybody's body is made for that.
Yeah.
Some people are more conditioned to sitting because they've done it their whole lives. But when I went from, a very active, business, which was training, to sitting in front of a desk for 10, 15 hours a day, my body did not like that at all. So I feel, people say, oh, of course your knees hurt and this and that. You've been running since you were 8 years old. But if I get out and I move consistently for a week or two, I feel so much better than just going out for 1 or 2 runs a week. It's amazing. Once I get out of my desk mode and get a week or two of consistent riding and running and swimming under my belt, just how much better my body feels.
Yeah, no question about it. Yeah, the sitting is the worst possible thing for sure for all of the reasons that we've talked about at length, certainly on our podcast and on our blog, the fact that it reduces your mobility and you tend to shut down your glutes, obviously, and develop some more tightness or additional tightness through the front of your hips. And that lack of balance and and just sitting in those static positions where your butt's kind of shut off is really ultimately pretty bad for you. And obviously, having come from the background you have where you were training at a relatively high volume, you didn't have much time to spend in a chair, Ken. I mean, when you're training 30 hours a week or more, right? But that kind of base has really served you well. And I have to believe, and I think you alluded to this in that interview, was, you know, your experience certainly has led to you having a heightened intuitive sense of your body. I mean, you're wiser now. You're smarter. You know your body a little bit better, so you're able to keep yourself away from, you know, any debilitating injury because of that wisdom and that experience.
Well, I mean, the only injury that's really come to haunt me is because of not listening, being, you know, doing something stupid. I went out for a run April a year ago when it was cool and wet, and I was going to run 6 miles out, 6 miles back to where the car was parked, and if things felt good, then I was going to do a couple miles in the opposite direction, you know, 1 or 2 miles in the opposite direction and back. And so the plan was to do somewhere between 12 and 16 miles because I hadn't been running all that consistently. And I got 6 miles out, and the run gets much nicer the further out I go. And I felt good, so I just continued straight out and turned around at 8. And when I got to 14, I'm sorry, when I got to 12, which would have actually been when I was supposed to be back to the van, I was still 4 miles from where I needed to be, and things things were tightening up, and I wound up hurting my knee because of it. And it was strange because it was the back of my leg and my calf that were tightening up. And the next morning I woke up, you know, the inside of my knee was slightly inflamed and
right.
Hurting. And so, you know, I'm still dealing with that a year and a half later, just that one stupid mistake. So you know, one run is never going to make you a better athlete, but one run can certainly hurt you.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can hurt you for a few months, and sometimes it can hurt you for years.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, that's actually some really, really good advice, you know, and something for people to really think about. And you're absolutely right. I mean, when injury happens or when there's something that isn't quite right, that changes motor control, and inevitably we put ourselves in a position of being a little bit higher risk of some injury. And then on the heels of that, we've got to restore that foundation and that original or authentic motor control, and then it takes some time for some healing. Now, what would you know, and I know if I was listening to this podcast right now, I'd be thinking to myself, because you must be asked training advice all the time, and, you know, what in all of the, you know, your experience for all of these many years, what are one or two tidbits of advice that you could offer to our listeners beyond that great tip you just shared?
Yeah, I mean, listening to your body and never getting that worked up about one or two or even three or four workouts, you know.
Right.
Knowing
don't be a slave to a plan,
when
right?
To pull back. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you have to know when to pull back. You're better off missing 3 or 4 days of training than
right.
Pushing through, you know, some niggly thing, and then you wind up missing 2 months. I mean, if you're consistent, missing a few days, and people say, well, that's not being consistent. But I'm talking about being consistent month to month, year to year. So, you know, taking time off when it's appropriate in the off season, and reading your body so that, you know, even when you're in the middle of a serious training session or block of time, if something doesn't feel right, you're better off pulling back for one or two workouts than going over the edge. And then my next biggest thing as far as training is, and I know a lot of people aren't as into it now as they were years ago, but I know this is the way myself and all the guys and girls back in the, you know, the late 80s and 90s, we were all putting in a lot of volume. And I think that I definitely believe that building a huge base is the best thing you can do for longevity in the sport. I relate it to the difference between a pyramid and going up a ladder. You can get really fit very fast, and you can reach a very high peak if you do a lot of speed work, which would be, you know, like climbing up a ladder. You can get there really quick, but you can only go so high, and the ladder's unstable, and eventually you're going to fall. Whereas, you know, putting in a lot of base work and building up from that is like a pyramid. You can go as high as you want. The wider the base, the higher the point can be. And it's more stable, which, you know, related to training means less injury. So, I mean, speed work has its place, but speed work has its place once you have the base work to support it.
Yeah. I mean, that's some good sound advice for sure, Ken, you know, and there's obviously a lot of a good science to support that. You know, it's interesting from a coaching perspective, you know, when we look at any individual athlete and what their strengths or weaknesses might be, certainly from my own perspective, I'm a big believer in the importance of integrating some what I refer to as functional strength work, making sure somebody's stable and appropriately mobile and strong. But I've always been very free to admit that part of the reason I was a big fan of that was that I felt you could perhaps, you know, cut some corners on the volume end of things if you could make sure your body was functionally strong. Because at the end of the day, you know, and you just stated it right there, was, you know, your ability to be consistent and also do fairly well at very long races is about not slowing down and not having the wheels come off. And if you're able to sustain a large or fairly large amount of volume, that's certainly going to be that's going to be a much greater chance of that happening, you know, that you'll be able to sustain an effort for a period of time. I mean, you know, even a 10-hour Ironman race, it's not that fast when you look at any one of the individual sports, right? A 1 hour swim.
Oh, no. Yeah. None of it's real.
It's not speed.
Even
it's
in the half Ironman, it's still not. It's not
right.
Speed.
Nope.
As would be considered by an individual sport athlete. I mean, if you talk to a, you know, if you want to relate world class to world class, if you talk to a world class triathlete, and they do a 112 split at the end of a half Ironman. That's a joke compared to a world-class runner that's going, you know, 103 or something. So
yep.
It's a totally different world. So, I mean, speed is a relative term. A 112 at the end of a half Ironman is flying, but it's still not true speed, and you don't need to do high-end speed work to do that. You need to do volume, and you need to do, more importantly, once you have the base, you need to do a lot of tempo work. So, and that's a safer bet than jumping on the track and running 400s, is to go out and, you know, do 800 repeats or mile repeats, where you're not going at that really high-end speed, which you really don't need. But you're getting some really tough work in at a much faster pace than what you're going to race on race day.
Sure.
I mean, I had a friend that years ago was doing Hawaii, and she was very worried because she hadn't done any speed work. She was in her 60s, and I'm like, well, what do you mean speed work? I mean, if you run the entire run, and except for walking through some aid stations.
Yeah.
That
you know, when your age group,
a hugely successful day for you.
Yeah, exactly.
So where yeah. You know, and I mean not run, I mean just jog, just, you know, yeah. Whatever, 13, yeah. 14 minute miles at that age,
you're going to do well.
Would produce a good time.
Yeah.
So, you know, so is it worth it for someone like that to jump on the track and do 400s or 800 repeats for the potential injury risk? I don't think so, because the benefits are too small. Now, if she goes and does something where she's running, if she wants to do a half Ironman or, you know, and you go 10 or 15% faster than what you will on race day, or maybe even 20% faster if it's a shorter interval, then you're teaching your body to go faster than what it needs to go on race day, and you are, you know, using different systems, which is important in training. You don't want to always just train at the same speed. So, I mean, that is important, but you don't need to run, you know, insanely fast compared to what race day is going to be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the way I think of it, and I think you're hitting the nail on the head, is it, you know, certainly long course racing is about resisting fatigue and slowing down less. And
yes, exactly.
You certainly can look back at your volume base and what you've trained your body is to be very resilient, right, to all of the soft tissue, et cetera. Now, obviously, you must have some very, very good mechanics. I can't remember the last time I've actually seen you run or seen you swim or seen you move, but, you know, at some point in time, and I think that's the challenge that I have as a coach, Ken, is, you know, working with athletes to understand that they really have to work on skills and work on improving their mechanics, or higher volumes just going to destroy their body. It's not really overuse, it's over abuse, really. So those are some of the things that we're working on here and that I continually work on. But there's a lot that really resonates, I think, with what you're saying. You know, I almost think
doing functional training, mm-hmm. of course, is definitely going to help with being able to overcome any issues as far as biomechanics. That's going to help you withstand the problems that you would have if you didn't have that core strength. So I do think that's very important. But when I talk about high volume, I guess you also have to understand where I'm coming from. I mean, I started doing endurance training when I was 7 or 8 years old. So for me to go out and train for 30 hours a week, it's not that big a deal.
Right. It was a natural progression for you, certainly.
Yeah, it was a natural progression. Basically, that pyramid that I'm talking about, I'm not just talking about building that pyramid up from, you know, spring training through your fall races. I'm talking about that pyramid being, I started laying that pyramid, the base of that pyramid was being laid when I was 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old.
Right.
And, you know, so that is a difference. So, you know, if you get someone that maybe did some sports in high school and, you know, maybe a little bit in college, and then they were away from things for a few years, and now they're in their 30s and getting back into stuff, you know, they need to be careful both with their volume and their speed. And probably the thing that would be the most important to focus on would be the functional strength. Then a proper amount of base work, volume type work, and then tempo work and speed work.
Yeah.
So it all has to be laid in the right format based on what your personal history is.
Absolutely. We're all an experiment of one, that's for sure. Yeah. Good stuff, Ken. Thanks so much. Let's talk a little bit about endurance sports travel. You know, one of the things I was thinking that I'd love to ask you, and I'm going to put it out there. I'll give you an opportunity to tell our listeners what endurance sports travel actually is, and then share some thoughts about that, and make sure that you mention the URL as well so folks can find that on the web. But I know before I forget, I want to make sure that, you know, you have the opportunity to travel to so many races because you're taking groups there. I want to make sure to get your tips on where you feel some of the most fun venues are and some of the best races. But let's back up for a second before I get ahead of myself. What is endurance sports travel?
We're basically a concierge service. You know, people say, oh, well, I don't, you know, I'm able to arrange stuff myself. which is true. I mean, it's very easy nowadays to book a hotel and a flight and car rental. But that's really not the kind of stuff that we're focused on. Our ground packages provide the hotel, but we do everything on site. So we have professional bike mechanics right there at the hotel. We pick you up at the airport so you don't need to rent a car, which, in a lot of locations you go and rent a car and you hardly use it.
Right.
The amount of money that you would pay for our service, especially if you're traveling to a race on your own and you rented a car just for yourself and weren't splitting it with someone, our add-on cost above what a hotel costs is not much different than the price of a car plus gas. So you're basically, we provide all the transportation, and then on top of that, you're basically getting all our services for free. And that's the bike mechanic, course tours, the expertise of my staff, the camaraderie in the group is something that's really hard to kind of put out there, is how important that is. The thing that draws me to the sport is the training, but it's also the people. And so because we're not just a U.S.-based company, when you go to an event with us, we can have anywhere from 10 to 20 different countries represented in our group. So you go and do a race, so you do Ironman Brazil with us, not only do you get to experience, the culture of Brazil, but you sit down at breakfast with somebody from Chile, and you sit down and have dinner with somebody from Germany, and then, you go for a bike ride with, people from three or four different countries around the world.
Right.
You really get to experience and learn a lot culturally, not just the culture where you're at.
Right.
That's something that I think is one of the biggest things about what we do is just the experience that people have, and not just the athletes. We gear a lot of what we do towards the family. So, the family on race day, we take care of them. We always have a hospitality area for them. And they're having a much better time because they've met three or four other families and other athletes. They're not just out there on race day waiting for one athlete to come around every hour and a half or 2 hours or more. They're cheering for all these people that they've met during the week. So it makes the trip a lot more enjoyable for your family as well.
That's, that's awesome. I mean, all of the things that you've just mentioned there, they really, as you said, they really resonate for anybody that's been in the sport for any length of time, because it is about the people, It is about sharing experiences. It is about meeting new friends and finding common ground among cultures that bring people together, right? And it's the spirit that really, I think, embodies the sport of triathlon. It isn't the commercial aspect or the MDOT stuff or even what's happening at the sharp end of the race. It's really about all of these normal, everyday people from around the globe that are trying to be better, right? That have this standard of excellence. They're trying to set goals, and so you're able to really help these people come together, man. That's really cool, And then you bring the experience of having traveled to a venue. I mean, how many folks go, I'd love to go do Ironman Brazil, but I'm not sure what it's like to travel in that country, or I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get around the venue. I don't really know it. You have the experience of having been to a lot of these venues, and you can save people a lot of trial and error.
Yeah, I mean, even if you're, from the U.S. or Canada, and you're traveling within North America, there's still value in knowing that all you have to do is show up, and when you get off the plane and grab your bags, we're there to pick you up and basically walk you through everything. And it just takes a lot of stress off that you don't need the week before the race.
Right.
And, with taking care of the family, that's another thing. When you're out previewing the course, or you're, going to registration, putting your bike in and doing stuff like that, if you're thinking, oh, my family's sitting back in the hotel and they're bored, and, you know, if that's wearing on you, that's another stressor you don't need. You know, you want your family to have a good time as well. And, you know, so feeling comfortable going to these venues, whether they're domestic or international, is a big part of what we're trying to accomplish. And that's why I started the company. Brazil was my first race as a tour company. And the reason I did it was I was involved with the race management back then. And we were trying to make it as easy as possible for people to go to the race and feel comfortable. Right. So that was the background for establishing the company.
Right.
And
yeah.
And I had enough, you know, I had enough knowledge through traveling with my parents, you know, from the time they were in their early 60s until, I mean, my mom's still going out to Kona. She's 86 years old. So I know what people, you know, that are traveling with their adult parents or older adult parents, what they need. I know what people that are traveling with an infant need, because my daughter Rhiannon traveled with me all over the world, you know, from the time she was born. So, you know, she's 20 years old now. So what a family with a five-year-old needs and what a family with a teenager needs is a little different. And what a family with a 75-year-old or 80-year-old parent traveling with them is different. Or, you know, somebody that has medical needs or something like that. You know, I'm able to advise them on where is a good venue to go with people and where is not.
Right. Good stuff. What are some of your favorite races? Obviously, Brazil is close to your heart, I'm sure. But yeah, where are some of the places that you really think are some of the best venues and best races to travel to?
Well, I mean, I'll start at the top, and that's a race that's coming up not too far away, and that's Pucón, Chile, which is my favorite venue. Not just the race itself, but everything that we do around the race. There's just, you know, we climb a volcano, we go whitewater rafting, barbecue up in the mountains overlooking four live active volcanoes. It's just
wow.
A spectacular trip. And then the race is one of the best produced races out there. So that's probably my top venue. And then Ironman New Zealand and Ironman Brazil, I guess, would be probably two and three quite equally. Both are great venues, great races, and then there's so much, you know, so much that you can do after the event, both in the area of the race as well as traveling throughout each of those countries. You know, I've done a lot of stuff up on the North Island of New Zealand. I've been to the South Island. It's just an absolutely gorgeous country, and then Brazil, I've been, you know, to Iguazu Falls and to the Amazon and to Rio. That obviously you're traveling greater distances in Brazil to go from place to place, but there's some really spectacular places to go there. Then over in Europe, I think my favorite event in Europe, of the ones that I've been to, and I've never raced, unfortunately, I've never raced Austria, but that is a great event. It's a great place to take a family because it's not in one of the major cities, so it's a little better for kids.
Right. Is it still in Klagenfurt? Is that
yeah.
correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's kind of reminiscent of kind of the, if you stay along the lake where we get our hotels.
Where the
they're more like bed and breakfast.
Right.
It's got kind of the atmosphere of what you would think of from the 50s or 60s, the kind of mountain resorts, you know, with the real homey type of atmosphere and, you know, kids just going off and doing whatever they wanted to, you know, all day long and feeling safe doing that. For couples that are going somewhere, you know, Frankfurt and Zurich are both great races, but not really the ideal places to take kids. But for couples, they're great locations, and the races themselves are, you know, completely different than what you find in the U.S. as far as the spectator support. I mean, Frankfurt's just amazing. I mean, on a good weather day, there could be 300,000 or 400,000 people throughout the entire course.
Right.
And you're just not going to find that anywhere else.
Right, for sure. That's some great stuff. Now, one thing that I was just thinking about, with slots to many of these races, and the races filling up so quickly in some respects in some of these venues, do you have the opportunity to offer individual spots in any of the races that you're traveling to? And I ask this, I don't know, but I figured I'd throw that out to you.
Most of the events that sell out quickly, we contract with the event to secure slots in advance.
Oh, excellent.
So races like Florida and Arizona and Lake Placid, pretty much all the races in the U.S. that we go to, we have slots for. And we pay a premium for them, but there is the added ability that, you know, you don't have to sign up, you know, the second it opens, which is great. And you pay a little extra for that. But in Europe, we have slots for most of the European races, New Zealand, Melbourne, Western Australia. So all the races that tend to sell out quickly, Ironman Brazil sells out now in 15 minutes, so we secure slots for that one and for Pecan. So it does give our clients the ability to sign up, you know, a little bit later than what you would if you're trying to get into a race that sells out in 2 minutes.
Right. Good stuff. So what's the URL, Ken? How do folks find you on the web?
EnduranceSportsTravel.com.
All right. That's probably what I would have guessed, but I think you
know what
I'll say.
Straightforward.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's long, but it's straightforward.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I know that for many of the athletes that I've come into contact with and some that I've coached over the years, the report back has always been, you know, A+ on the services that you offer and the work that you're doing. And clearly there's a huge need there because you're addressing so many, as you mentioned, the issues with, you know, helping to support the family and thus taking a lot of load off the athlete and really making travel and all of the other, you know, the stuff that just, you know, swirls around an athlete trying to race effectively that makes getting to these races so hard. You're able to just alleviate all of that stress and take care of that. And that's,
I
mean,
well,
that's
I can
awesome.
Tell you one of the things that I really, obviously I love the sport. I love training. And something I want to see more of is, as the sport has grown, you have a lot of one and dones. There's a lot of people that do an Ironman or a half Ironman and then walk away. And they might go back to doing some Olympic distance or sprint races, or they just walk away from the sport completely. They don't make it a lifestyle. And there's different reasons for that. Some people, it's just on their bucket list. And other people, it's just too difficult to fit it in with your family and to make it a lifestyle. And that's what I'm trying to help, and that's what I'm trying to promote. I want to see people enjoy this sport for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years for the rest of their life.
Right.
And if you don't fit your family in with it, if you can't make it work with your family, then you're not going to stay in the sport. So, you know, to see an athlete go to, you know, because it's easy, they go to Ironman Wisconsin because they live in Chicago or something and they can drive up. And they do that 5 or 6 years in a row. To me, that's, you're not paying back your family. I mean, you're away every weekend training, you know, on Saturday and Sunday and some during the week. And then you're taking them to the same venue over and over again.
Right,
Ironman,
exactly.
Wisconsin. Ironman Wisconsin's a great venue, but do you want to go there 5 or 6 years in a row?
Exactly.
You know, so why not take your family out to, you know, Whistler or to Lake Placid or, you know, over
South America.
Or South America. You know, I mean, it's a great payback for them putting up with, you know, all the stuff that you're putting them through. And in a lot of cases, it's a little bit more effort to do something different like that. But It certainly shows that you appreciate what they're putting up with.
Right. It's funny you should mention that. I mean, I was thinking back. My two children are now 21 and 27, but my first Ironman, actually my second Ironman race was Ironman, the inaugural Ironman California, which was in 2000. Mm-hmm. And my son was 8 years old at the time, and he still talks about that trip. I mean, we went out there, we stayed in Carlsbad and, you know, rented a little place on the ocean, and he still remembers, you know, playing out there in the water and the whole venue, everything that was going down. I mean, it was just something, as you mentioned, you know, because, you know, that was a different place and a really a vacation, a trip that allowed me to go out and race, but them to really enjoy themselves, really does create an opportunity for sustainability and then making the sport a lifestyle. And that's really cool, because that is really what it's about. I'm sure, you know, the work that we do here in our lab is very much about making sure that people maintain balance in their lives and in their bodies, and that they can keep doing this for as long as they want to, hopefully, you know, well into their later years. And in a very real way, you're doing the same thing with your business, but from a different perspective, obviously, but with the same end goal in mind, which was, you know, sustainability and a lifestyle that allows for the sport to really enrich our lives in multiple ways, you know, good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I quite often it'll be a family member that actually decides where the race is going to be the next time.
Right.
So that they go to, you know, they go to Ironman New Zealand and they have a wonderful time. And, you know, an athlete's going to have fun no matter what. I mean, you know, they're out there on the course doing what they want to do. It's, you know, making sure that the family has a good time is what's really important, because, and then they'll turn around and they'll say, oh, where else do you guys go? You know,
right.
We've always wanted to go to Europe and we've never done it, you know, and, you know, the athlete's going to have a good time. Now there's, you know, multiple races to pick from in Europe, so they can pick a time of year or a course that suits them, but, you know, then their family gets to go to Europe.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, well, listen, we've had a great time visiting, Ken. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy day. I know you're getting ready to travel somewhere, right? Where are you going next?
Down to Cozumel, and then straight right. From Cozumel to Western Australia.
Western Australia, right.
And then,
that's that,
and then
that time of year.
Brisbane to visit my daughter who lives down there now. So,
awesome.
Yeah, it's about a 3 or 4 week trip.
Wow, man, you're going to get some airline miles, huh? That's for sure. Good stuff. Well, thanks, Ken, for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to this edition of the Pursuit Athletic Performance Podcast. Again, check out EnduranceSportsTravel.com, and of course, don't forget to come to PursuitAthleticPerformance.com and check in for any of the latest updates. Check us out on Facebook, and on the heels of anything you've heard today, send us any questions at info@PursuitAthleticPerformance.com. And again, Ken, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day, everybody.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Pursuit Athletic Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a 5-star rating and review here on iTunes. Be sure to head over to PursuitAthleticPerformance.com to subscribe for free tips and strategies to help you get strong, get fast, and unleash the amazing athlete in you.